Have you ever wondered how a world-class competition pilot, an airshow aerobatic pilot, trains and performs? Well, we're about to find out here in the Aerovert.
I'm Jeff Rowland.
And I'm Cleo Satterfield.
Well, today we've got David Martin with us. You might have seen him maybe in the last few years at an air show where he's fly his Beach Baron in an aerobatic routine, dead stick routine and everything. It's quite fascinating. So we're very fortunate to have him with us, and he can explain how he got to this point. It's not as simple as it looks. So welcome, David.
Glad to be here.
How did you begin? That's what I want to know.
How
did you begin as a pilot? I know we've known each other a long time, but I know that you are a third generation pilot, and I want a little bit of history on you.
Well, my grandfather and father both were airline pilots and pilots, and I can't really remember. I've always wanted to be a pilot since I can remember. I always liked airplanes. You know, as soon as I got old enough to be able to hold the controls, I started flying.
Did you always want to do aerobatics?
You know, I can't remember exactly when I started. I think I did, but I was thinking about that. I'm not exactly sure at first I wanted to do aerobatics. I don't even know if I knew what aerobatics was. I did go to some aerobatic contests when I was pretty young and was impressed with the pilots like Charlie Hillard and Gene Soucy and Art Scholl. I got to see all those guys when I was probably 10 years old, and I think that made a pretty big impression on me.
Do you have somebody teach you, train you, or did you just get up there and get aggressive?
No. Well, my grandfather, first, he taught me how to do a loop and roll in our Cessna 150 aerobat, real hot rod aerobatic airplane. that was like when I was about 14. But I wanted to go past that, and I wanted to take an aerobatic course. And at that time, a famous aerobatic pilot named Dwayne Cole was in the Fort Worth area locally, which that's who I really wanted to fly with. So when I got out of high school, I wanted to go and, you know, learn aerobatics with a professional. But I didn't have a lot of money, and so I found Dwayne Cole was the best, but he was like twice as much. So I was going to go to the cheaper guy because I could get more time. But my dad stepped in and said, no, you're going to fly with Dwayne Cole. So I did. And Dwayne Cole not only teaching me the more serious part of aerobatics, he also, I think that's when I really started wanting to be a competition pilot, because he kept saying, well, you know, in competition you do this, in competition you do that. So that kind of got me wanting to be a competition aerobatic pilot. That was kind of the start, and air show too, but at first it was mostly just competition.
I want to get into that difference is in a minute, but I want to say something about Dwayne Cole for a second. David introduced me to him many years ago. David and I have known each other a long time, and Dwayne Cole was obviously very impressed with him. And I remember him saying he would introduce David to someone and say, man, David, he's amazing. He flies Cubs and King Airs and everything. Now, Dwayne Cole was from a generation where that was the widest gap humanly possible in his mind. That was the ultimate compliment for David. And I'll never forget that. If you got a compliment like that from Dwayne Cole, you were something, in my opinion. And, you know,
I was really lucky to get to fly with him, too. I mean, he just happened to be living not too far away.
Absolutely.
He's the one that planted the seed.
Yeah, and then, you know, there was other aerobatic pilots that lived in the area. Charlie Hillard, which you know, was kind of my hero growing up. And I got to know him by buying a clipwing Cub from him, actually. And he I would go visit him at his Ford dealership, and we'd talk aerobatics. And he would, you know, he's always saying, well, you need to start competition. You need to do this. You need to do that. And that kind of directed me in that direction.
I'd like to know the difference from your perspective in competition flying and air show performing. I want to get into the specifics of how you train for competition, but just generally competition flying versus air show flying, because those guys always direct you to competition first.
Yeah, and I think we all, most of us now, try to get people to start in competition and then work into air shows, because competition is very regimented, and you're always being judged. I mean, you never fly a perfect maneuver in competition. In air shows, it's the other way around. Nobody ever knows if you screw up, except you.
Right.
You know? So the competition really gets you the basics of aerobatics and beyond, I guess you would say. to stay in a certain area, to perform maneuvers in a certain way. And
when I am around competition pilots or aerobatic pilots, I always hear them say something about the box.
The box,
yeah. Yeah, and for somebody who's not a pilot and new to this
well,
thing,
box
what
is
the box?
The box is basically a 3,300-foot square in the air. It starts at 300 feet, and you're judged. You have to stay in that box in competition. If you go out, either way, you get downgrades. You get penalties.
So is this something on a GPS that goes dee-dee-dee-dee-dee as you get closer?
No, there's no GPS. You have markers on the ground,
okay,
and that's about it. And
in competition, of course, there are people on the ground watching you.
Yeah, right? you have people on the corners. If you go out of the box on the corners, you get a penalty.
So in
air shows, it's...
How do you practice staying in the box?
Well, you have a box. I had one laid out on the ground, and I just... Every time you practice in the box.
But did you have somebody on the ground
helping? My wife.
Yeah, Martha. Really?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, I didn't have... When I'm practicing daily, we didn't have people on the corner markers.
Right.
So they're just telling you you're basically in the box. They're not... I mean, if you go out 100 feet, they're not going to know.
Right.
So normally in practice, you would never have anybody on the corner markers.
How did she communicate with you?
On the radio.
Got it.
And then she had a recorder also. So
I'm thinking.
My wife could tell me all the things I did wrong, and I had to say yes.
She must have had a heyday with that.
Actually, she was great. She had it much worse than I did. She'd be sitting, days and days in the summertime in the hot sun, sitting in an old field.
I'm thinking with your head back this the whole time.
And I'm up there having fun, flying. And she was, yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about this part. I know that you were on the World Aerobatic Team several times. I mean, you flew these airplanes, transported them across the ocean to get to, Eastern Bloc countries. I mean, you flew in some fantastic places and had some fantastic experiences. But to prepare for that... And that's not for the faint of heart. I want to explore and need to tell people how much preparation was involved in you preparing to be. And David was a gold medal winner in the world competition. He's got some first place awards, which is very unique. There's only two Americans that have ever won the World Aerobatic Competition, and they're both very good friends of David. And so I want to know how you prepared for this.
Well, first, it's a long road to get there to start with. I mean, you have to work your way up through the competition levels to the unlimited level. And then to get on the U.S. team, you have and when I was getting on the U.S. team, we had two different contests we had to fly in, Fond du Lac and the Nationals, and you had to be in the top five men in the scores at the end to be on the team. So, it was a long road first to even get to where you could try to get on the U.S. team. And, the first year, I built my first airplane to fly unlimited in, and by the time I got finished building it, it was kind of obsolete, so you had to go buy it, a new factory airplane, which was very expensive. And so I did that, and I was preparing the first time I was really might get on the U.S. team was 1995. And I had the new airplane, and I was training very hard. That was pretty much at the time that we brought in real coaching. We started hiring coaches, and my coach was Sergei Boryak, which was from the former Soviet Union, and he was on the Soviet team, and he was pretty much invented the coaching job, and I was very lucky to have him as a coach. So I was all ready for that first team. I'd been training real hard, probably flew 300 hours that year in the new airplane. Then the week before the contest, my new airplane broke.
Now, you don't mean the engine. You don't mean the engine.
No, the wing.
Oh, my gosh.
So I couldn't fly it. And fortunately, there was Mike Gulling was there in the same kind of airplane, and he let me fly his airplane, which was fine, but it's kind of like race car driving. So you have two airplanes that are exactly the same. Well, they're not exactly the same.
Yeah.
I mean, they look exactly the same, but they don't fly exactly the same. And, it's just a little bit different and also I was new then. I didn't make it by one maneuver. So it's the world competition is every 2 years, so you have to wait two more years to get on the team. And then I did get on the team the next time. And the first time we went to Slovakia, we got to go on the C-5. We took our airplanes apart. we had not very much apart, and took them on a C-5, and we got on the C-5 with the airplanes and flew to Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany.
Wow.
Took the airplanes out on the ramp. They weren't very friendly to us at Ramstein Air Force Base.
They're still
like,
mad
what are these aerobatic airplanes doing on our Air Force Base? And so they stuck us out in the grass, and we put our airplanes back together. And then we fly to Slovakia and stopped somewhere in Germany on the way. And, you know, this was all new to me. Some of the other team members had done this before, but I'm like, I'm flying. It's interesting. When you go on the C-5, one day you're flying your airplane in Europe. The next day in the United States. The next day you're flying around in, you know, Slovakia.
Yeah.
And the only way you can do that is a C-5 Galaxy Transport,
yeah.
Which we had the first couple of times on the team, and then we lost it. And it made the whole getting to the competition much harder. But it's a long, like I said, it's a long road to get to that point. And
when you said 300 hours of preparation, do you fly once or twice a day, every day? What does that entail?
Probably, when you get close to the competition, yeah, two or three times a day.
Wow.
Five days a week.
Two, three times a day?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Quite a commitment for you and for Martha.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to go back to something else you said. I'd love to talk to you about doing cross country. I mean, there's no straight roads like between here and Oklahoma in those countries. It must be just absolutely fascinating. But when we first met, you were building a monoplane.
Yeah, a Laser.
Yeah.
200.
And I remember one of the very first conversations we had, I said, man, why are you messing with that? Why don't you get a cool Pitts like Charlie Hillard won the world contest with, you know? And you explained it to me that the monoplane was the future.
Mm.
And, boy, were you right. We went to Oshkosh and saw Leo Loudenschlager fly his Laser, which you copied.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, if I had a hot dog in my mouth, I would have swallowed it. It was an incredible, incredible spectacle. And that's what David followed in, that's footsteps. And amazing things that you've done with the monoplane since then. But like you said, you outgrew that. The sport outgrew the Laser, and you had to get into a more powerful airplane.
Yeah, and you know, it was, I couldn't afford other airplanes at the time. I had to build it. You couldn't, when the Laser was new, there were no plans. You just had to build it. And fortunately, I got to be friends. Again, geographics, Leo Leidenschlager came and practiced in North Fort Worth for the World Nationals. So I would go watch him, and I got to be friends with him. And then when I decided I wanted to build a Laser, I could call Leo day or night and ask him some stupid question, and he'd answer me.
Right.
And he was very supportive the whole time. And it just took me a long time to build it. I had an Air Force career in the middle of that, too. So I did fly the Laser in the Nationals for a team trial the very first time, which I didn't get very far in the first time. I only got on the second flight. I managed to G-lock myself. That was the end of that.
Okay, I need to know what a G-lock is.
Well, I was flying F-16s at the time, and we trained a lot, went to the centrifuge, and I knew what G-lock was. It's when you actually lose consciousness from too many Gs. The blood rushes out of your head,
David,
you lose consciousness. But I'd never done that in F-16. So I'm at the aerobatic contest, and it's hot, and I might have had a cold. And I was dehydrated. And so I do this maneuver at the end of my competition. It was a maneuver you never want to do. Inverted to a positive is the worst thing.
Okay.
If you're negative and then you turn it and roll positive, that's when you're most likely to G-lock.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And so it was a half loop up. I did this and rolled up, and I just kind of and everybody said, "Where's he going?" And I kind of flew off to the north.
So you learned that rule by experience.
But I knew exactly what it was because I'd gone through the training in F-16. But I never G-locked myself in F-16. It was in my aerobatic airplane.
But you had G-suits in that airplane, right?
No, well, in F-16 you did, but not in that.
Oh, I want to show this. For the viewers who don't get to see inside the cockpit of an aerobatic plane. David, do you know what that is?
Yeah, that's a sequence. I don't recognize that particular sequence, but that's how we draw it.
You can read this that quickly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, they put this inside the plane?
Yeah, on the...
Okay. And you watch this, you can...
Yeah, it's kind of your cheat sheet.
Okay.
It's not as important. There's several flights in the competition, and the first flight is a flight that you get to practice all year long called the known flight.
Uh-huh.
And you always have that sheet in front of you, but on the known and then the freestyle, it's not important. Where it's really important in the flight that separates everybody is the unknown flight. And that's when each country or each precip, if you're at the nationals, it's each person, mm-hmm. puts in a maneuver, and then you make a sequence out of it, and then you have to fly it. And, of course, there's so many combinations, there's no way you could ever practice it.
Oh, wow.
So you don't get to practice it. I mean, you just memorize it, and you have that on your panel. And I was never very good at it. I always just had it in my mind. I mean, it would be up there to look at, but you just walk through it 100
yeah.
times. And again, that kind of separated. That's the hardest flight to fly.
Is that what you guys are doing when I see you walking around going?
And we look like idiots.
Yeah.
Okay. And air show pilots do that too. You're just hand flying it, we call it.
Yes.
But it was much more important in an unknown flight.
Like, how long lead time did they give you on the unknown?
Usually the day before you mm-hmm. get it. So you have a day to walk through it.
Soak it in.
And then at the world competition, you'll have a coach that'll talk you through how to fly each maneuver. But it's really difficult. It really separates the real good pilots.
Yeah.
And there was one guy that was a friend of mine that flew competition. It was flew F-4s in Vietnam. He was an aggressor pilot, flew MiGs in Nellis. He'd flown everything. And he said to me one time, he said, David, you know, I've flown all this different stuff, and there's nothing compares to flying an unknown.
Yeah.
It's the most difficult thing I've ever flown.
How interesting.
And that kind of puts it in perspective.
Yeah. I remember going with you to Arrow Valley a couple of times, watching Leo and Jim practice at that time before the Nationals, and I was always intrigued with the 4 minute, how he could nail that mm-hmm. last maneuver to a second, because they start counting off mm-hmm. points per seconds off, right? And I thought that was a wonderful thing, and David, I think, was an expert at that. Well, let's get into, I won't say you're a big wheel at the IAC, but you're like on the board or at the IAC or something.
I have been on the board.
Yeah, I've been on. And so the International Aerobatic Club, how's the membership doing? What's your...
Well, it's kind of gone down over the years. It's about 4,000 people right mm-hmm. now, and... you know, it's the governing body of aerobatics in the United States, which is under the NAA, which is the National Aeronautics Association, I guess, which mm-hmm. is under the FAI. So the IAC has, I mean, they have their license to do national competitions and select pilots. And but, you know, it's more than that. The IAC has all the way from very basic starting maneuvers all the way up. So it's if you're going to be a competition or an air show pilot, it's best to go fly at some IAC contests. Yeah. At least be introduced to IAC.
Sure.
So they set the known sequences mm-hmm. and everything every year, and they do all
yeah,
that?
Yeah. For the unlimited, the FAI actually sets the unknowns, mm-hmm. but for everything else, the IAC does.
So, you know, well, I was fortunate. David got to take from Dwayne Cole. I mean, what a great guy. But my first aerobatic... was with David. He taught me. And I was never sought competition level, but I love the fact that a normal airplane could compete, and it's becoming more and more difficult. Do you see that? But as the sequences
yeah,
get more complicated?
Yeah, but they still, we try. I mean, it's always seems to be a battle.
Mm-hmm.
We need to keep we call it the grassroots people, you know, the small airplanes, cheaper airplanes. We need to keep them, you know, being able to fly in competition.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, I haven't flown a world competition in 10 years, and I look at the current sequence, and I'm like, man, we never had to do all this.
Wow.
You know, it's progressing.
Yeah.
And that's just the way things are, I guess, you know.
My memory is Sportsman, Advanced, Intermediate, and Unlimited. Is there there's a lower one, right?
Yeah. What do we call
Primary?
It? Primary.
Primary,
yeah.
Yeah.
Primary is just a loop roll and a spin.
Yeah.
That's beginner level?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a good way to start, though, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember I had a program from the Nationals here when they were at Oak Grove, and it had Charlie's sequence in it that he won the World Aerobatic Contest with, and it was like an advance today. It was quite
yeah.
phenomenal, the
mm-hmm.
differences. And so it has really moved up.
Of course, the airplanes have, too.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Well, you know, this move to the monoplane and the performance has just got to be astonishing.
And the one thing that's kind of sad is, you know, you could build your own airplane that could be competitive in world competition back in Leo's day, and now that's impossible. You know, you have to be flying one of the you know, $500,000 airplanes.
Yeah, now. Well, give us some names of some top aerobatic airplanes. We all kind of know about Extra.
Extra, of course, Extra has dominated the world competition for about the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Used to, when I was flying, the Russians were flying Sukhois, which were Russian airplanes. The French were flying CAPS, which is a French airplane, which I did fly. Now it's mostly everybody is flying Extras. The Russians timed out all their Sukhois,
and
you know they're not airworthy anymore, so they're flying Extras. And I haven't actually been to a competition to watch the Russians fly Extras. I'd like to see that
because
you know they'll fly differently. But you know there's some new airplanes right now that are not haven't that are well, like the Game Bird.
I was going to ask you about that.
It's flying competition, but I don't think a Game Bird has actually got to world competition level yet. It's not like it couldn't. It's just nobody in particular is flying one of those right now.
When is your next performance?
Well, now I'm just an old air show guy, so a boring air show guy. So,
okay, but, all right, when's your next air show performance?
It's in April at Sun and Fun in Florida. I'm going to fly my Young Master, which I'm looking forward to. They actually asked for it. In recent years, everybody wants to see the Baron because it's a little different. But at Sun and Fun this year, they was like, can you bring the Young Master? And I'm like, well.
So you're going to fly the Young Master from Texas to Florida?
Well, I don't know how I'm going to do that yet. So that's to be determined.
There's many stories about us moving that Young Master around this country.
I've flown it three times at Oshkosh, and I've flown it up there three times, and I've never flown it home. So
how's it get home?
In a truck.
Oh. Got it.
But between here and Oshkosh, there's lots of green fields. Between here and Florida, I don't know, there's like alligators.
Oh, yeah.
Not that the Young Master's ever quit on me, but.
Truck sounds really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for volunteers to drive the truck. So
one thing David's done when he moved into the air show side, he's kept his competition look, which I always admired. You look really sharp when you're doing air shows. And he likes to tap into history. Bob Hoover, everybody knows that name, and David does this dead stick act in his Baron, and then you have to pull him up on YouTube sometime and just watch his routines in his Young Master. He does the Bevo Howard, used to fly by with his hands out on the last pass, inverted. David does that. He does nod to the old guys that started him in this business, and it's pretty humbling to watch him. It really is. David, we appreciate it. I don't know what else to ask you. We could go on for hours. Besides being a world-class air show, you know, pilot, he had an Air Force career. He flew F-4 fighters and F-16 fighters for their National Guard. He flies Mustangs. He's, you know, got the letters to do that. And I think one day he's going to fly Bruce Winter's ME-109.
Yeah.
Nobody else will probably ever get to fly it except Bruce, and it's one with an original Daimler engine. It's going to be quite something.
For an air show performance?
No,
just to fly it.
Well, we might do a we're talking about doing a he's got a Mustang and a ME-109, and I fly that Mustang. So we're talking about doing, you know, a little
formation
fight.
Flying.
No, fight.
Oh. Something
no, we're fighter pilots. We're not going to fly formation.
That's
we're going
right.
to fight.
That's right. Yeah, we haven't seen that in 70-something years. Yeah. Well,
That's good.
One more thing about him. He flew every day for 5 solid years. You think about that little intriguing record. So it proves he's an aviation nut. He's a charter member of the WAA. You can look that up if you're game enough. And he's going to be on Aeroverse in the future. That is a fact because he's going to do some demo flying for us and comparing airplanes. He's going to fly a jet in an air show here coming up, we're pretty sure, in Oshkosh. So keep your eyes on David. He's a real treasure to have local. And thank you very much, David, for coming.
Glad to be here.
You bet.